Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. This lecture was organized by the Humanities Forum of the Commonwealth Club of California, and it's done in association with Humanities West. And I'd like to introduce Professor Jindong Kwai. He is the Associate Professor of Music at Stanford University and for Performance. He's an orchestra conductor, and he's the co-author of the book, Beethoven in China, How the Great Composer Became an Icon in the People's Republic. I've been talking about this for a while, and what an interesting story it is, and what has happened from why it got started to its outcome. So, Professor Kwai, thank you very much.
Thank you, George. I am definitely a very loyal listener on the radio, but thank you for the invitation to come here, and thank you, everyone, for coming. And this lecture is supposed to be done by my wife, Sheila Melvin, and me together. Then just last minute, she had to go on business trip. She can't avoid it. So that's somehow for me is a little relief because she talked very fast. So now I can talk slower. And before I start to discuss our topic today, I want to you look at this machine right here, and I will play a little bit from it. Okay. So this is a manual operation recorder. And so the phonograph, this is a 78 turns, and you have to wind it. Then you put the needle, start. This is a Beethoven piece. Give you a little idea. As you can see, it doesn't need the electricity. You wind it, and this machine came from the Stanford Music Library. And we collect some of this, and it's not completely working. That's why I have to stop. Otherwise, the pitch will go down very soon. The reason I want you to hear this because this is how my first encounter with Beethoven's music. And that was, it was in the middle of the Cultural Revolution when I was just become a teenager. And, you know, even in the Cultural Revolution, everything Western and forbidden, but you're a teenager, you just want to do everything the government doesn't want you to do. So we secretly reading those very famous Western novels. And this is one of the things also I did. One day, a friend of mine and classmate, he asked me, he said, I want to show you, do you want to listen to some foreign music? So then we went to his home, and this is what he showed me. So there's a machine, and then there's a big book of this recording, you know, because each side of this recording only can maintain 10 or 12 minutes long. So you have to have a big book of this whole Beethoven recording, a book. So in the book, in the front page, there's a Beethoven's engraved head shot. And there's right Beethoven, a big letter. So that's my first time. And we have to lower the curtain. We have to lock the door. Then we start to listen to it. The most I remember that struck me very much deeply is this power of the sound and the rhythm. And also this kind of multi-layer, multi-levels of musical material happening at the same time. And growing up in China, I played the Chinese instrument, erhu. Usually Chinese music mostly is one melody, one line music. But this is so many lines, and that struck me the most. And so before that, I already started to learn the violin, but mostly to play some revolutionary music. And the reason I start to learn the violin because when the Cultural Revolution started, and I was 10 years old and 9 years old, so my father didn't want me to go on the street to do some terrible things. So he fined 24 renminbi or the $3 in the consignment shop. A Japanese violin. So he came and said, "You like music? Play this." That's how I started violin. But after I heard Beethoven, I started to search Beethoven. I started to search all the classical music pieces, Mozart, Haydn. That really put me on this want to be a musician dream. And then after the Cultural Revolution, finally can go to college. That's in 1979. So I decided to go on music. And that year, when I was freshman in college, there was the Toronto Symphony, Boston Symphony, and the Berlin Philharmonic all came to China to perform. So that's as a freshman, I didn't miss any rehearsal and performance. And so to watch how C.G. Ozawa conduct the Boston Symphony, to watch how Carrion to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic. It's an incredible experience. And it's in the stadium. Actually, it's in a Coliseum, 5,000 people there to listen to it. And you can hear a pin drop. Just that's so quiet, so moving. And what struck me is also, when you look at Carrion, when he conducted Beethoven's 7th Symphony, he doesn't move much. His eyes closed, but he has complete control of this orchestra. And that song came out, I have never heard live like that. And on the other hand, C.G. Ozawa, when he conducted, almost every part of his body is moving. And same, he has this complete control of the orchestra and brings so much color to the music. So that's when I decide I want to be a conductor. After I graduate from college, I'm going to be a conductor, and I want to go to the West to study conducting. So I can say my own musical experience really relate with Beethoven. All those orchestras came to China, they played Beethoven. And C.G. Ozawa conducted Beethoven 9 with the Chinese chorus. And after the last chord, and people are clapping, and I actually jump on stage, bring my program, ask C.G. to sign. Then he signed for me. I still kept that program. And then in the same night when I went home, I just write a poem on that program. It's a young person. You have a lot of dreams, and music really can just move you so deeply. You want to pursue. This is what I want to do. And so Beethoven bring me to the music. And now, but today we want to talk about how Beethoven came to China, right? Before we do that, I want to give you a very short, history view of how Western music came to China. I think many of you probably not noticed the Western music came to China at more than 400 years ago. First of all, China has its own music. This is called Bianzhong, or what you call the bronze bells, set of bells. It was unearthed in 1970s in a tomb of the Marquis quite a famous market, and he is a whole set. And this set, it's a, I believe it's a dated in 433 BC. So that's 2,500 years ago, at least. And it have 65 bells. And the biggest one is about 60 inches high. And small ones are like 5 inches high. And so that's, as you can see, the history of that. And what during that time is exactly the Confucius time. And Confucius is, you know, he think music is very important for society and for a human, for a person. So he has three elements to say if you have a good education, you have the three elements you have to learn. Shi, Li, Yue means to educate somebody, you should start with poem, the poetry. Emphasize on ceremonies and finish with music. So those are three elements. And so you can see this is more like a ceremony part. You know, most of the traditional classical Chinese music is in the court mostly for ceremony. And then for Western music came to China. I dated in 1601. And the reason because that was the first Jesuit missionary Italian Jesuit Matteo Ricci. He came to China in 1601. So he was sent by the Pope. And they want to go to East. They want to make a Christian available to Asian people. They went to, like, Father St. Francis went to Japan first. But then they find out that, you know, Japanese only learn what Chinese doing. So then they decide they have to come to China. So for many years, they came to China, but they stopped in Macau. China never allowed them to go inland. And what Matteo Ricci did is he stayed in Macau, but he learned the language. He dressed like a Confucius, then he make friends with Chinese people. Then the Chinese people say, oh, you're a friend, so I'll bring you to Beijing. So then he arrived in Beijing 1601 to meet then the Ming Dynasty Emperor Wan Li. So he presents some gifts. Then one of those gifts is a clavichord, as we see earlier. So you can see, very easy to carry. And this kind of keyboard instrument, China never had. So we never had a keyboard instrument. So this is a very curious for the empress. So from there on, and then Wan Li allowed the Matteo Ricci to stay, you know, but the thing's old, and then it started to continue to allow missionary to come to Forbidden City. But the one of the rule is, you came to Beijing, you die here. So, yeah, so they gave them a piece of land, actually allowed them to set up a church. So so this is in the Ming Dynasty where Matteo Ricci came. Then after Ming Dynasty will be the Qing Dynasty. The Qing Dynasty, two of the most important emperors, one is Kangxi, one is Qianlong. Qianlong is the grandson of Kangxi. Kangxi is a very, very interesting person. He interested in many, many things. Especially he interested in Western science, mathematics, and music. So he started to ask more judges to come, missionaries to come, and even he write a letter to the Pope, said, send more musicians. So from there on, actually more musicians start to come. And this is one person I just want to mention. His name is Pedrini. He's Italian as well. And he actually sent by the Pope who want to come to Forbidden City just for music. He is a really musician, and he can compose, he can play, and but somehow he's supposed to get on boat in Portugal. He missed the boat, so he catch on another boat, but the boat took him to South America. Yeah, from South America, he stayed for a year, then he find another boat, went to Manila, Philippines. And so he stayed here 1 year, there 2 years, and then finally he reached Macau. As soon as he reached Macau, they said, you need to go to Beijing to see the emperor. So he went to Beijing. By the time he came to Beijing, it was 10 years later. You can see, and you know how long it takes, but also you can see those people's dedication. They, you know, that's my mission is I'm going to accomplish. Yeah. So when he arrived in Beijing in the morning, in the afternoon, he went to the Forbidden City, and from there on, he started to teach music. And some of those eunuchs, many eunuchs study with him, and also there are a few children's sons of Kangxi also study with him. And on the right, this is the textbook back then and was using. You can see on the top is a Western notation. It's the first time ever, you know, I can see Western notation in China. That's the first time. So my wife and I wrote a book like 10 years ago. It's called Rhapsody in Red, How Western Classical Music Became Chinese. So that's when we did research, I went to the Forbidden City Library, we find this textbook from that time. And so this is Kangxi. And after Kangxi, Qianlong, and the grandson of Kangxi, also very, even more energetic, you know. And so during his time, basically, the Forbidden City already have a very big list of the instrument, Western instruments, how many harpsichord, how many cellos, how many violins, and they all presented by missionary or diplomats who came to China, they present to the emperor. And so I would say the first wave of classical music came to China, but it really never went beyond Forbidden City. And then China, back then, in the Qianlong's period, China was like one of the richest countries in the world. They control, I think, 50% of GDP around the world. And they have silk, they have China, and they can get all the silvers from Europe, from the rest of the world. And then after a while, the European, you know, after the Industrial Revolution started, and the European become stronger, then they make more products, they want to have a market, so they start knock China door. And this is a very famous Marconi mission to China in 1793. And they used the opportunity of the 80th birthday of Qianlong, try to convince Qianlong, and we also have great things. Please open the market for us. You know, so that, but the mission was failure, and Qianlong didn't really care. And he even write back to King George to say, Who are you? You know, we have everything. We don't need you. And so basically it's a failure. Bring lots of foreign influence, including Western music during that time. But because of that, when the British, especially British Sea, you know, use diplomatic way cannot work, then they start to gradually use different way, like a military way. That's how, in the end, the Opium War, as we all know, right, it started. So the from 1840, around that time, until probably 1949, and Chinese people always refer to the 100 years as century of humiliation. And all the strong countries in Europe came to China, beating up China, and have war with China. China always lost the war, and they have to gradually to pay money to those foreigners, and after Opium War, they have to open 6 port cities, and so that's what I see start the next wave, and then from there on, because they have to open the 6 poor cities, and some European people start to come to China to do business, merchants. Shanghai, it became one of the important cities into the 20th century, and early 20th century especially. So this is a little history, right? And then we can just go to Beethoven. Beethoven, introduced to China by two different channels. One is by Chinese intellectuals and artists who promote his life story to make available to make available to Chinese people. And second line is the Westerners who play Beethoven's music or play Western music for themselves. As I mentioned, many of those port cities become lots of foreigners start to have a long residence there. So for the first one, the Chinese, and the first time Beethoven introduced to China is in 1906 by this person called Li Shutong. Li Shutong came from a very well-to-do family. His father has a salt business, and then he got pretty rich. And in the early 20th century, and China become rather weak. And the Confucius exam, which is their way of select officials, really become useless. And even the Qing Dynasty in the end had to abolish the Confucius exam. And then in 1911, the Qing Dynasty just, it's gone. So that's it made a lot of young people just searching for new, where we go, where China's going to go and where they're going to go. So they put their eye to the West. And the closest country they can go is Japan, because Japan got reformed quite early, so they become very westernized. So many young people, including him, went to Japan to study. So that's how Li Shutong studied Shakespeare, studied Western painting, Yo-Yo painting, and also studied music in Japan. And then in 1906, this is what he did. And on the left, in Japan, he played Shakespeare as a lady. He played like a lady. And then on this side is his oil painting. You can see it's quite Western influenced. And then he in 1906 he produced this called Little Music Magazine, and it was edited in Japan and printed in Japan, then sent back to China for distribution. And in this magazine, he draw himself a charcoal painting of Beethoven. Then he has a bio of the Beethoven in the book, and a short bio to say Beethoven, how his father's drunk, and he went through so many turmoils, he cannot hear, and his love life also is bad, and his nephew betrayed him, and so on. But his music become the most powerful thing for human being, and everyone loved it. So that was the first time. And back then, you don't have a recording, you don't have a radio, you don't have anything. Basically, when Beethoven introduced China, it's not really by music, it's by the person, human being. So it's the beginning. Then from there on, there are more people like him and study in the West, in Japan, or even Europe, start to bring back more Western music. And this gentleman, Xiao Youmei, he went to Leipzig. He went to Leipzig to study music. And so he got a doctorate degree in music, and his dissertation is about the traditional Chinese music ensembles. And then he came back to China in 1920. He had a dream. He wanted to reform Chinese music. He thinks Chinese music is way behind. And he had the idea to say, if Chinese people every week, like Germans, every week go to concert and to play music, there will be less crime, there will be no prostitution, the world will be a better place. That's what he said, how naive he was. But he's, yeah. But in Beijing, he start to create some Western music. And in 1922, he created a Peking University Orchestra. And the orchestra really collected whoever the musicians possible he can find around Beijing, Tianjin, and that place. And so you can see there's one of each woodwind. There are a few violins and one viola, two cellos, one bass, and there's even two timpani. And it's 15 people. He created a 15-people orchestra. And there's a start to play Beethoven Symphony. How do you think Beethoven Symphony can be played by 15 people? Actually, it can do it. You know, during Beethoven's time, the orchestra can be only 30. So it's so he basically, you can see the only foreigners on that corner. He's Russian, so he is a pianist. So whatever the parts they don't have, so he will cover the parts. Yeah, so they played Beethoven Symphony number 2, number 3, number 5, and number 6. And not complete symphony, but movements. So it's the earliest Chinese orchestra professionally playing Beethoven. So it's a Chinese side. Then let's go to the foreign side. As we mentioned, after Opium War, the poor city start to have foreigners to stay there. And Shanghai, it's the most important port city. And this is the turn of the early 20th century in Shanghai. As you can see in the bones, it's quite busy. Lots of things going on. And so that's what it's Shanghai. And the population start in the late 19th century, start from 20,000, then went to 30,000, 50,000. It's a big foreign residents there. And Shanghai also very unique is because of the treaty, Shanghai, the city divided to three parts. One is called international settlement. It's controlled by British and American. Another part called French concession is controlled by French. And the third part is called Chinese city, where the Chinese people live. So in the international concession and international settlement and French concession, they have their own government, they have their own law, and they have every control themselves, almost like a little colonial in the Chinese city. So the Chinese law not apply to them. Because of that, they can, you know, that's why they want to explore of their own culture, and they start to create this art. And the Shanghai Symphony Orchestra actually was created in 1879. Created in 1879. It's like a couple years older than the Boston Symphony or Chicago Symphony. So the Boston Symphony was 1881. Yeah. So from 1879, it started as a public band. And so they started to play in the park in the summer and gradually to make it to become bigger. But from 1879 until 1927, almost 50 years, the orchestra, there's no Chinese in it. You know, there are some Filipinos, and they recruit. And then they recruit some people from Europe, especially before the First World War, there are more German came to play in its orchestra. This is the first, it's the earliest program, the Shanghai Symphony today, this is called. They still kept. This is from 1911. And you can see there's one finale of Beethoven Symphony No. 3, Eroica. It's the earliest we can find the Shanghai Symphony Orchestra playing the Beethoven Symphony. So then the First World War started. Lots of German musicians were drafted to war. And so the orchestra really went downhill. By end of the war, the orchestra only have 14 people left. And then in 1919, this maestro Mario Pacci, an Italian, came to Shanghai just doing concert. He is a pianist. So he was contracted to do a couple piano recital. He came to Shanghai, but he got sick. He got sick, then he just had to stay there for two months. And he is a very energetic person. And during the 2 months, he meet people, he meet old musicians, and he gave a fabulous, wonderful concerts. The last concert he gave, he created orchestra to play Mozart Coronation Piano Concerto. So he played the piano and same time conduct the orchestra and made all the Shanghai people start so excited. They said, oh, we need to keep this maestro to revitalize our orchestra. So that's how the municipal government hired him to be the music director of the later called Shanghai Municipal Orchestra. And when after he came, he played lots of Beethoven symphonies, and he really made this orchestra become the best orchestra in the Far East.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Even in Japan, you know, during that time, there are many more orchestras, actually bigger size, very much bigger. But most of the members in the Japanese orchestras were Japanese. But this orchestra still, you know, most of the members are from Russian, from Russia, from Europe, and it's quite an impressive list. And, you know, this after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, and lots of white Russians came to China in the northern city of Harbin, and many of them later moved to inland, to Shanghai. So that's they have all those musicians from St. Petersburg, from all those famous conservatories. And then gradually, you know, there are more European came. So, and this is in 1936, Mario Pacci conducted the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, The Last Woman, for the first time in China. And they started engaging Chinese chorus to perform with them together. And so Beethoven become more famous. And then from 1920, 1930, there are lots of Beethoven books translated and introduced into China and by all different kind of people, and mostly Chinese, you know, translate. This is very interesting when I did this book research. This is the Beethoven name translated in different ways. Yeah, you can see if some of you if you know Chinese, I can read from up down to say Beethoven, Peterkofen, Beethoven, Huatofen, Baitihofen. It's all sounds like Beethoven, you know, but it's very, very interesting. But also you can see how Beethoven becomes so popular in China. One of the very important reasons because people want to learn his life. And he seems like his life is the best fit for Chinese people during that time. Because Beethoven lived in, as maybe mentioned, turmoils, lived in difficulties, lots of obstacles, but he overcome. You know, he keep fighting. And that's what's shown in his music. And that's what the Chinese people believe. And this person, Fu Lei, he actually, after all those different names, and he actually make Beethoven, that what the Chinese call Beethoven, become one translation nationwide from him. And he went to France and studied French literature. Then he just when he read Romain Rolland's book, The Story of Beethoven, he just struck by the power. And so after he read The Life of Beethoven in Paris, he wrote, "I burst into tears and suddenly felt as if I had been enlightened by the divine light and gained the power of rebirth." So he started to translate that book. And then after that, he went back to China. He started to translate more about Beethoven's book. Romain Rolland, I think for many of you know, is a very famous French writer, and he won Nobel Prize for literature one of the years. And he is big Beethoven fan. And he wrote The Life of Beethoven. Also, he wrote a novel called John Christoph. And that's a big volume book. And he created this character, John Christoph, based on Beethoven's character. Yeah, so that book also later translated by Fulay, by Fulay, and in China. When I grew up, that's when I secret read Western novels, that's one of the books I read. And many people in my generation, in this young intellectual level, and we read that book. So this is that. And so that's, you can see the Beethoven gradually take roots in China. And then, you know, there's a war happened. Japanese invade China. There's a big war from 1930s and 1940s. And that time, and some people, even those people went to the conservatory, Shanghai Conservatory, want to study Beethoven, start to question Beethoven. One of the composer, his name is Nier, and the China National Anthem, it's based on his song. And so he played the violin. He came to Shanghai and wanted to study violin, become a musician. But then during the 1930s, after Japanese invasion, he wrote in his diary, he said, "I slave myself 10 hours a day to become classic and to play Beethoven. But so what? That can save China? No." So he said, "Wake up before too late." The reason, because of when the war came, Shanghai, it become we call orphan city. A lot of people just went there, and you have nowhere to go. Every day, the government had to take like 1,000 or 2,000 dead bodies on the street. So for young people, when they see that, you play Beethoven, you cannot save your country. So many of those young people looking for new ways to contribute to the country, to save the country. One of the way they see there's a hope is a communism. So many of those young people went to Yan'an, which is the headquarter of the communism. So when they went there, they actually have more freedom. They can play Shakespeare there, they have played Bach there, and it become very vibrant society in the few years, from 1938 until 1942 or so. And then there's become a debate of the Western music and Western civilization and compared to the Chinese tradition. And in 1942, Mao Zedong gave a talk and he collected all those artists together, and he gave a talk. It's a talk about the art. It's a very famous art forum in Yan'an in 1942. He touched the two very basic points. Actually, even today, had a very deep influence on Chinese artists. One, he said, there's no such thing called art for art's sake. Art to have to serve the politics. And for today, we are in war. So the art had to serve the war. And so that's the first. Second, he said, we serve the war. So who we serve? And we have to serve the workers, peasants, and soldiers. Because those are the people fighting the war. Those are the future of our country. And so that's the first point. The second point is, and as an artist, because you have to serve to those people, then you have to go to them. You have to learn from them. And so that's how made all the artists went to the countryside, went to the villages, and collect the folk songs, and then they come back to compose. And many of those music was composed during that time. You can see music become politics. Yeah, this debate has been continued from 1940 until 1949, when the communists finally won the war, controlled the country. They still debate. They still debate. But at the same time, they even Mao Zedong said, you know, we can borrow the foreign things, but we have to serve Chinese purpose. Of course, his Chinese purpose will be the politics and the control. And so that's in 1949, they won the country. And then up in 1950, there was a period, actually, a very art, it's a very flourishing. And until early 1960s, from 1949 until early 1960s, it's a very flourishing for a while. And they start to use Beethoven as another way, as a revolutionary character. Yeah. So that actually tradition came from Russia, from Soviet Union back then. Because Soviet Union always, like the Beethoven, even Lenin. This is the Lenin. It's an oil painting from Russia, from Soviet Union. Lenin is listened to with Gorky sit on the table. Gorky is a writer, right? And then with a very famous Jewish pianist are playing a Passionata Sonata. So, and he listened to it. And he just loved Beethoven. And he talked to his sister to say, what astonishing superman music. It always makes me proud, perhaps naively so, to think that people can work such miracles. But then he added that he couldn't listen to music often because essentially it make him compassionate, which was bad for revolution. Yeah, so which was like a hugely difficult job. Or yeah, so that's what Lenin. But Beethoven in Soviet Union, actually, they almost made Beethoven's like a Soviet Union's a second home of Beethoven. They play many Beethoven symphonies, and they even implemented Beethoven into like a education in the secondary education. And then China learned a great deal because in 1950s, Russia is a big brother of China. You know, they give China everything, and China sent hundreds of thousands of people there to learn science, learn how to make rockets, and learn music. So, and in 1959, and there are some Chinese artists already came back to China. 1949 is the 10 years anniversary of the People's Republic of China. And suddenly, Zhou Enlai, the prime minister, said, we need to celebrate this 10th anniversary with some foreign music, especially Beethoven, because there's an East German orchestra, Dresden Philharmonic, will come to visit, and Khrushchev will come to visit. So they want to make a big festival during October 1st, around that time. So then, early of that year, they start to collect all those musicians. So many musicians went to countryside, workers, peasants to be part of their life, then call them back to say, we need to have 7 months concentrate on Beethoven 9. So 1959, they performed the Beethoven 9, and this is the performance. And there's a lot of story involved with how they rehearse, you know, how to make decision. And there's a conductor make decision. They said, no, conductor cannot make decision. The political leader had to make decision and how this movement should be played. And so it's a very, very interesting. And but from after that, that's 1959. And after that, not long, it become bad. The situation become worse. And so in early 60s, there's some people start to criticize Western music, criticize West people playing Western music. So, and then instead, they start to have a revolutionary music. So this is the one of the called symphonic music, revolutionary symphonic music. It's just called Shajiabang. As during the Cultural Revolution, that's what it started. The Cultural Revolution, I think you all know, right? I don't have to say too much. And from 1966 to 1976, I experienced some of those. And those are actually, I experienced it. And those people, you know, put it there, and there's 10,000 people down there. And in the end, they will take them to the ground to kill them. So many people, many musicians, whoever loved music, really suffered. Remember I said that the Foulet translate all those French, the Beethoven books, and the Red Guard went to their home and beating them. This is he and his wife. And in the end, they just hanging themselves to kill themselves. So in short, just less than 3 years, from 1966 into 1969, just Shanghai Conservatory, there's 17 professors committed suicide. Yeah, some of the reasons are unreal. There's one professor, actually, she can play all Beethoven 32 piano concertos when she went to the conservatory. And then after 1949, they invite her to come back because she's so good to rebuild this piano department. And she did. She came back from overseas and just devoted herself to the Shanghai Conservatory. And one thing she liked to do, she liked to wear high heels. She liked to wear Western-style dresses. So that became accused during the Cultural Revolution. They got all her high heel shoes, hold them together, and put on her neck and ask her to march on the street. And in the end, she just read the note. She said, "I'm tired." Then she just turned on the gas, just killed herself. So those are many people been killed themselves. And there are very few lucky ones actually escaped. Master Tsung, I don't know if you know, he escaped. He is the president of Beijing Central Conservatory, and he decided to escape, so he had to dress himself like a countryman and escape to Guangzhou. From Guangzhou, they had to hire a snake, basically a people smuggler, and put him on the bottom of a boat and escape to Hong Kong. Then when he got in Hong Kong, he went to the American embassy. The American somehow take him to Philadelphia. It was a very big news. And in of course, all his brothers, his family, his cook, you know, his driver, all get punished in China, and because of he escaped. So that's one of the he escaped. And then of course, there are a lot of people survived. Many of the people survived. I think touching stories that they have their face. You know, I know this person, he's a violinist, Tan Shuzhen. So he was the first violinist admitted to the Shanghai Symphony Orchestra in 1927, as the first Chinese violinist played there. And then during the Cultural Revolution also, he was taken to the conservatory. Every day, he had to clean 142 toilets. So that's his job. He live in a little room under the stairway. And he said, "I didn't kill myself because he's Christian." He said, "I'm Christian." And every time I look at outside, and I feel, you know, everything will be over. You know, there will be good days in ahead. So he is one of the person that really, really survived. He died when he was 95 years old. It's really a good friend. And there's another person. He, Lu Hongen. He's a timpanist and a conductor. He loved Beethoven. And so he attended many of those political studies, and he didn't really like it. And during a required study session of Mao's Yan'an talk, you know, the talk I mentioned earlier, Lu Hongen responds to the criticism of Beethoven by asking, "Should Beethoven look up to the workers, peasants, soldiers, or should the workers, peasants, and soldiers look up to Beethoven. I think the latter. The workers, peasants, and soldiers should raise their artistic cultivation to learn from Beethoven. That's what he said. So during the Cultural Revolution, he was obligated to participate in the criticism session and against those well-known intellectuals, and he refused to do it. But they threw him in jail. One time they asked him to criticize this very famous professor in the Shanghai Conservatory, which was his teacher. He refused to do it. And not only that, you know, he criticized, he said, I'd rather be a counter-revolutionary than a part of the big revolution and orchestrated by that witch, which is Jiang Qing, is Mao's wife. You know, Mao's wife actually, and they know each other back in the Shanghai, old Shanghai time. So he know who she is. So because of that, he really officially was, arrested to throw into jail. And every day, a severe beating and abuse, and at one occasion, guard dumped the food on the floor, asked him to eat it, and he's going to have to eat it because there's nothing else if you don't eat it. And so in the end, it's a lot of those abuse, and he was a prisoner 1144. And then one of the guards said, 1144, do you want to live or die? And he said, I want to live, but I don't want to live like the walking dead. Without freedom, I would rather die. The Cultural Revolution has destroyed truth, friendship, love, happiness, peace, and security and hope. So that's it's recorded by one of his cellmates. And the cellmates, and he talked to that cellmate. He said, if you go out, I ask you to do two things. First is to help me to find my son, who has been sent to Xinjiang, to the really far away, and tell him how his father died in jail. Second, if you ever had a chance to escape China, is to help me to do something I have wanted to do my entire life. Visit Austria, the home of music. Go to Beethoven's tomb and lay a bucket of flowers. And tell Beethoven that he's disabled in China. Lu Hongwen was humming the Missa Solemnis as he marched to the death. That's what he did. Every time they beating him, he came back to his cell. He sing the theme of Eroica Symphony, Symphony Number 3, and he sing Missa Solemnis. Then in the end, they killed him. And the killed him just like the picture I showed you, you know, with many people, with 10 people. Nine people they killed. The next day, and the government newspaper announced that who got killed. Because what? And he is one of those in this newspaper. And when they killed him, they don't want him to yell out. So they cut his throat so he cannot talk. And after they killed him, then they sent a bill to his mother, ask for the bullet cost. So that's the Cultural Revolution. And after the Cultural Revolution, Beethoven was used diplomacy. When Kissinger visited China in 1971, Kissinger went there first, and the Premier Zhou Enlai asked the conductor to say, you know, Kissinger German, we need to play some Beethoven for him. So the all the musicians are in the countryside, and those they have to call them to come back to play the Beethoven. So which Beethoven they can play? Okay, they start this class. The conductor said, we should do the fifth. And then Jiang Qing and his people said, no, we cannot do that because that's a fate, right? And that's feudalism. You cannot do that. And Li Dolun said, the conductor said, let's do Beethoven third, it's Eroica. And then they said, no, we cannot do that. That's about Napoleon. Yeah. In the end, they settled in Symphony No. 6, Pastoral, because they talk about the peasants. So they started to play Beethoven 6. And then they played Beethoven 6 for Kissinger. In his memoir said, that's the worst Beethoven I've ever heard. Yeah, then after that, the next important thing is the Philadelphia Orchestra visit China in 1973. And so Eugene Ormandy led the Philadelphia Orchestra visit China. He already programmed many things. And after he get on the plane, and the diplomat here get the code by the Chinese government, said, we want Eugene Ormandy and Philadelphia to play Beethoven 6. So they, the diplomat just panicked because they call back to Philadelphia, Philadelphia, they're already gone. And also, maestro hate Beethoven 6. It had been, played for many years. But then the Chinese diplomat said, you have to do Beethoven 6. And so in the end, when they arrive in Beijing, and the diplomat have to really nicely to talk to maestro to say, we have to do Beethoven 6. Yeah, and in the end, Eugene Ormandy said, okay, I'm in Rome, I listen to Romans, so I'm doing Beethoven 6. And in the beginning, he said, we don't have music. And Chinese said, we can find music. And we don't have this. Oh, we can have this. So they did Beethoven 6, and that time, Mao's wife came to the performance. And so on. Okay, this is the Eugene Ormandy on the Great Wall. And also, in the end, the Li Dolin always, the Chinese conductor always want they can play Beethoven 5th, right? So Eugene Ormandy attend the China Central Philharmonic rehearsal. So in the rehearsal, the Chinese conductor conducted the first movement of Beethoven 5th Symphony. Then after the first movement, he went down to give the baton to Eugene Ormandy, so the maestro, could you do the second movement? So maestro just get on and did the second movement of Beethoven 5th Symphony. So that's that's the culture. After that, Beethoven become the hottest item in Chinese world. And in 1977, the China Central Philharmonic, first time, that was Beethoven's 150 years of death. So they report to Central Committee, say, we want to commemorate that day. We want to do a Symphony No. 5. And the Chinese conductor, Li Dolin, and then the Central Committee had to meet him to prove until like 2 days before the date, they proved. But orchestra had been practicing. So the ticket sold out, and suddenly the central radio station started to have a live broadcasting. And in 1977, in March 25th, I believe, that they live broadcast the Beethoven 5th Symphony. And for many Chinese people, that when they hear that, they feel, oh, finally the Cultural Revolution is over. Especially for artists, for musicians, painters, and all the artists, when they hear the government radio can play Beethoven, they finally realize, okay, we can have a new chapter. Yeah. So that's the Beethoven. From there on, Beethoven become regular. And for today, the classical music in China, it's flourishing. There's about 40 million young people are learning to play the piano. There's millions of people learning to play the string instrument. In anywhere in the United States, any orchestra, you can find Chinese players come from that country, and there's some Chinese stars as well. And in China, and they in the past 10 or 20, even not 20 years, past 10 years, they started to build this theater, a grand theater, opera houses, concert halls. And this is Shanghai Concert Hall, Shanghai Grand Theater. And this is Beijing National Performing Arts and Theater. And this is Tianjin Grand Theater. And the Qingdao Grand Theater, and Zhengzhou, some of those cities, what I know, those cities are like a countryside, but now become, it's a big, every city want to build a grand theater. There's a Guangzhou Theater, and Hefei. Hefei is truly country. And this is the Harbin, where I mentioned, northern part near Russian border. And the leader, in 3 years, they built Harbin Conservatory of Music, They built a Harbin Grand Opera and a Harbin Concert Hall, all in 3 years. It just opened last year. Yeah, so it's a big booming of classical music, and Beethoven definitely is the most played piece. And also, all the foreign orchestra visit China, they know as long as they play Beethoven, people will love it. Yeah, so that's it's about, it's a short time. I just want to give you an introduction. I brought a few books. There are more details in the book. I hope you can get a chance to read them. Maybe we can have a few minutes of questions.
Yeah, we can have maybe two questions. And I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Kai at Stanford University speaking about Beethoven in China. It was a great review of history, and it's also a very interesting idea, which is repeated 100,000 times, of how different cultures affect each other over long periods of time with little pieces until it comes to what happens. People don't think of it that way, but it happened for thousands of years almost exactly like that in different areas.
That's right.
So who has a question? Who would like to ask a detailed question? Anybody?
So I'm just curious, who are other very popular composers now in China?
Well, besides Beethoven, Chopin.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chopin. The piano, exactly. Yeah, the traditional piano. But also this Chopin, the symbol, it's more like a nationalism. So he is a symbol of a nation, a symbol of nationalism. And he loved his country, Poland. You know, and here we think, sometimes we say he's French and Polish, but actually in China, definitely Poland, Polish. And his music somehow, it's really, I feel there's a natural connection with Chinese music itself. It's a very transparent, very lyrical, and very touching. So that Chinese people... like Chopin the second, I will say. And other than that, they like Tchaikovsky, they like and some of the Russian music. But actually, the 20th century music, still not. Even Shostakovich, you know, politically very important figure, right? But in China, they don't really think that way. So it's really interesting what the different world view a composer in different ways.
They like the difficult challenges, too. Right? I mean, those are all difficult to play well and then to play naturally at the same time.
Yeah.
One last question.
Where are most of the musical instruments manufactured in China, in particular the violin?
In China, manufacture lots of instruments. In the past 5 years, I think the piano and China manufactured more than 70% of piano each year around the world. So they basically produce 70% of piano in the world. They don't produce the Steinway. They don't produce Yamaha, the top line. But from 0% to 70%, they're all Chinese made. And some of them bearing foreign names, but they all made in China. And the violin, I went to some violin shops. Basically, there's one violin shop is in an old high school. And if you walk into that, each the classroom, there's like hundreds of thousands of violin hanging there for you to choose from. It's really well made. And it's hard to select which one's better, right? So it's basically, if you pay, for example, if you pay $1,000, they will give you five violins for you to choose. You will pay $20,000, they give you 10 violins to choose from. And if you pay $50,000, they will give you 100 to choose the best one. So it's instrument making in China is huge. Many, basically, around the world, if you look at the learning level violin, string instrument, they most made in China. And some people buy this very original instrument, came back, then made more work, then put their label on, and to sell them in like a doubled price. So it's
Now I have a good friend in New York who's a classical musical organizer, and he brought Lang Lang to Curtis Institute in Philadelphia to study when he was 13.
Yeah.
And he's brought several of other top Chinese stars into the West. But you know, whenever anybody asks what's happening to classical music and how come it's losing popularity, he says, where are you measuring the popularity, because in Asia, the popularity is going way up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing is I always get interviewed by some media to say, do you think the future of the classical music is in China? You know, because you can see this big booming. And my answer will say this. I will say, depending on how you define classical music. If you define classical music as we say today here, like the way, I don't think China can save Bruckner, Wagner, or Schoenberger or something. And because they are just never had that culture. Yeah. So, but if you think China can contribute to the 21st century classical music new wave, that maybe. Because when you go to China, you will see orchestras and they play probably 50% of their repertoire is new music. Mm. And opera houses, every year there's a new, tens of new operas being performed. Well, of course, many of those are probably junk or government, you know, activities. But I think some composers actually really work hard, want to some have great creativities.
One last question. Do you think we can bring the Chinese architects over here to make some grand theaters in our American city?
Well, that's actually, the best grand theaters are all designed by foreigners.
Yeah.
Not really Chinese. Yeah. Yeah. German and Zaha, yeah, all those are the best. It's a French, and they all. So what do you see? China has money,
yeah,
and the money actually is in government. Mm-hmm. So government decide to build this, and the government decide to build this. Actually, this is a very easy way to do it. As if you're a leader of the city, a leader of the province, you build this theater, and then people will like you because that's Chinese culture, like from Confucius. You are a leader, you have to be a cultured person. And then you build this, they view you as a cultured person. And the problem now is after they build it, you have to have good program in it. But they don't want to pay musicians anymore. They don't have artists. So that is the next step. I think they can do better.
Well, it happened in Vienna too.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thanks a lot for coming.